C2SP. Number 13B.
Actually, it's also always quite a statement when Mrs. Eddy in the second one shows the nothingness of matter, the belief of the nothingness of matter, because this is always the hardest thing to accept, because one is constantly faced with matter, one always pushes against matter, one always knocks against matter, and to say matter does not exist is really a hard thing to say. And it has always been, so to say, the laughing stock for the opponents of Christian Science, because they say, well, you run against a wall, a brick wall, and then you see if there is matter or not. Actually, this is usually the symbol they take, but this has also been the symbol of those great, great physicists like Niels Bohr, who were the founder of the new physics, that have seen that matter actually does not exist. Even he, at that time when he was showing that matter is not really substance matter, that it is just a mortal concept, even he, in one of those big meetings in Copenhagen, which was a very well-known meeting of all the big pots, the Nobel Prize winners for physics and so on, he said, well, you run against a brick of wall and with your head, but what you actually do is that wall only exists in your construction of your thought. It doesn't exist. So it's nice to know that when one look back right to the 1920s, that those big thinkers were already seeing that from the point of view of physics, that we actually run against the wall, but that wall is not the material wall, that is the construction of our own thoughts. So from that point on, I think Christian Science had a better basis to put forward its main points. One of it is that matter is not real. They also, David Bohm, one of the leading physical scientists of our generation, he said that all what we really know about matter is actually only a construction of our own reasoning, of our own thoughts, so that the consequence of it is that actually we should put physics in the domain of psychology, because it's something that exists in our thought, and psychology is that science that takes care of our way of thinking. This is a great statement of a brick scientist to say that actually physics is now a department of psychology. And he says, actually, what we see in physics, what the universe does, is not so much what the universe does, but what we see, but to bring, so to say, our conception of the universe in consonance with the way we are thinking. It has nothing to do with the universe itself. We only look at the universe and see there our own conception and try to order our own conceptions according to our way of thinking, so that we reconcile, so to say, in our thinking, that disorder becomes order, that we bring order into disorder in our thinking, but that it has actually nothing to do with what's going out there. There is nothing out there. There is only a way of thinking. So one begins to see more and more that physics approaches closer and closer, so to say, the fundamental postulates of Christian Science, that really matter is not reality, and therefore we have the right to deny the reality and the existence of matter. Physics will be the earth helping the woman. Exactly, physics, which has always been regarded as the very opposite of spirit, is now actually being the servant and the handmaid for supporting the great postulates of Christian Science. Or John Bell, another of those modern great physicists, he says, space and time are only for our physical senses real. They are not real. That reality is not in them. So also he sees that that reality must be of a completely different nature. Now, this is, in a way, another kind of spirituality, that we believe really that there is an intelligent universe, an intelligent material universe, that the stars have intelligence to run around the planets to run around the sun, that there is order in the stellar universe, and that there are laws in the stellar universe, so that there are intelligent matter at work. This is another kind of spiritualism. It's the working together of matter and intelligence. And more they see, as I said, that this is not so, that they are only construction of our own mind. Now, let's take soul, and the main epitome here is that spiritualization. We start always out with spiritualization, that's our great question here in the third part, becomes a present possibility when we reject the knowledge of good and evil. We know that the tree of good and evil is the very opposite of soul. It is the whisper of the serpent that says you should know good and evil. Again, a mingling. It's again a kind of spiritualism, that good and evil intertwine and they work together, and that something like the tree of life in the midst can at the same time be the tree of knowledge of good and evil, that life can be good and can be evil, that life can be spiritual, that life can be material, etc. So the spiritualization, she says now here, will be a possibility when we reject that, when we reject the serpent's whisper, so to say. And she starts out with that serpent and the tree of knowledge. First as mind, namely that the knowledge of good and evil still represents man as merely an offshoot of the material senses. She begins again with the belief, what we still believe, that we still believe in the opposite of soul. In old scriptural pictures, we see a serpent coiled around the tree of knowledge and speaking to Adam and Eve. This represents the serpent in the act of commending to our first parents the knowledge of good and evil. So here the suggestion of the serpent is taken up, the knowledge of good and evil. Namely, a knowledge gained from matter or evil instead of from spirit. Again, we have the question, where should we start? Always start with the synonymous term, never start with something separate from the synonymous term. Only then can we get true reasoning. The portrayal is still graphically accurate. For the common conception of mortal man, namely a burlesque of God's man, is an outgrowth of human knowledge. Here you have again the tone of mind, or sensuality, a mere offshoot of material sense. So we have here very clearly soul as mind, soul in the counterfeit of the serpent as commanding to eat from the tree of sin, of good and evil, soul, the identity of soul, the true man of soul, and its counterfeit, a burlesque of God's man, that's the counterfeit of it, a deflection of it, against soul, and that is just an outgrowth of human knowledge, of human conceptions, namely of sensuality, a mere offshoot of material sense. So a knowledge of material sense is soul and mind. So everything starts again that we say, well, where does all that dualistic sense of good and evil come from? Where does it start? It actually starts with us and not with God. We are accepting that belief. It is human knowledge, and knowledge gained from matter or from the material senses. So we can say, well, that is not the basis. So the subject develops further, comes to spirit, says soul as spirit. Evil is based on the false belief of two opposite powers, of which error seems to be the superior. Having said that it is a knowledge of good and evil, we ask now, what is then evil? What do we call evil? So here, spirit answers that. Uncover error, and it turns the lie upon you. This is a very well experienced situation. Everybody experienced that. The moment one uncovers error, it turns the lie against us. You uncover an error in a friend and you tell him, and he says, you too. So it turns the lie at once against you. Until the fact concerning error, namely its nothingness, appears. Can you hear now the nothingness? We are in the third part. The moral demand will not be met. So just by saying that matter is nothing, the moral demand will not be met. And the ability to make nothing of error will be wanting. So we have not only to state that error is nothing, but also we have to make error nothing, or else something is wanting. We should blush to call that real, which is only a mistake. The foundation of evil, how we come to the foundation of evil, is laid on a belief in something besides God. So evil here is defined as believing in something besides God. That's evil. So it is not something that has to do with a moral sense of things or a legal sense of things. It is really to believe in something besides God, which shows that evil is much bigger for a Christian scientist. I mean, much a bigger concept, much more a greater concept, a bigger concept, I think that's all right, than for the ordinary man. Because for the ordinary man, evil is just the opposite of what he considers good, of what he considers good. That's evil. But for Christian scientists, evil is not the opposite what we consider the opposite of good, but what is that which is not one with God, which is the belief that there can be something, a reality, next to God. So the foundation of evil is laid on the belief in something besides God. This belief tends to support two opposite powers. Instead of urging the claims of truth alone, we have here, so to say, the origin for a false logic. Namely, we have here the origin of the dualistic logic against the one value logic. See, the moment we have, she says, the moment we have something besides God, we have a two-ness. We have God and that which is besides God. So this belief, she says, tends to support two opposite powers, two opposite values. So the moment we are believing in something besides God, we build on a dualistic logic. It gives the, or, now, let's say it gives the basis of a dualistic logic. Whereas, if we would not have that belief in something besides God and would only have one God, then the one God can only have a one-valued logic. And that's what we have to arrive at. We have to arrive at the one-value logic, or else we are constantly living in a dualistic universe. So, actually, we can see a dualistic logic, no matter how logic that dualistic logic is unreal, is evil. And that only a monistic logic, a one-value logic, is real. So this belief tends to support two opposite powers, could say two opposite values or two opposite realities, so to say, instead of the one-valued logic, instead of urging the claims of truth alone. See, that alone gives the sense there is just one reality. The mistake of thinking that error can be real when it is merely the absence of truth, leads to the belief in the superiority of error. It's all absolutely logical in here, you see. It again shows this. I'll read that sentence again. The mistake of thinking that error can be real, that that which is besides God is also real, when it is merely the absence of truth. See, the absence of truth. Usually she would say, well, the mistake of thinking that error can be real when it is not real. That's usually the way she reasons in the textbook. But here she reasons differently, because she has to prove here the third part, namely that that which is besides God is an absence of truth, that there is no besides God. God is reality, and the belief in something besides God breaks that unity of God and man which we try to attain, and therefore is an absence of truth. So this rendering is very seldom. It's appropriate here in this context. And this leads then afterwards to the superiority of error. Because if you have two, then one of them is always superior. Then either you choose the superiority of truth over error, or you choose the superiority of error over truth. It's then in your hands, because you have then a dualistic logic, then it's in our hand to choose it. It's no more in the hands of God to choose it. We have made the first error, namely of believing in something besides God, then we are free, really, in that dualistic mind to choose the one or the other as being superior. Always again saying, you see, fundamentally behind that text is always the same drive. See that the incipient stage, can you say the incipient stage, the first step, the first stage, the is that you handle that. Once the first belief has come in, you are right down on your right down the mountain. You can no more climb up. It just goes, everything goes right down. One belief just snowballing the other belief and snowballing other beliefs, and these beliefs snowballing multiple beliefs, and there is no more a stop. It is the incipient, is that the right term, incipient step? The first step? Yeah? Good. So that is always the main point, to watch out for that. If that is watched, then we can really stick to our unity with God, to admit that man is God's own likeness. And that gives us the mastery over the whole idea. The moment we are not watching that, we are on the, we sledge down. Can you say that? You go down the road. Yes. I wish my English would be a bit better. I could give you a nicer picture of it, how it is. Okay. Then we come to soulless soul. Today it is recognized that soul is able to control the body. So having shown up to this that a false belief leads to the superiority of error, now she begins to correct it and shows the superiority of soul. So somewhere the correction must come in. We read it here. Do you say the time has not yet come in which to recognize soul as substantial and able to control the body? Can you hear now? The control the body, soul is always that which is superior to the body, controls the body. Remember Jesus, who nearly 19 centuries ago demonstrated the power of spirit and said, "He that believeth on me, the works that I do, shall he do also." And who also said, "But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshippers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth." Another quote, "Behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation," said Paul. So she gives a few biblical citations that all say the same thing. Now is the time. Now, because she starts out that sentence, "Do you say the time has not yet come?" So she asks, is the time not ripe to see that soul controls body? And just says, yes, the time is ripe. It was already ripe 1900 years ago when Jesus and Paul were talking. They said the very same thing. Now is the time, now is the time, now is the time, now is the time of salvation. So as to refute that belief that always says, well, I'm not yet there, I have not yet enough understanding, when I have once enough understanding, then I will do this and that and the other. And breaking that belief, that tenacious belief, that it is always in the future that reality works, that it's always in the future that truth is true and that truth can be demonstrated. She wants to say it's now that soul is already superior and substantial to and able to control the body. Here's another subtone of principle in it. The moment we come to principle, we have the divine logic. Now she takes up that point that we had before, where I was explaining how the dualistic logic comes into existence at all, that it comes into existence through man's belief in something besides God and makes error superior. So she says, now we should turn away in soulless soul and says, now you should see that soul is superior to error and can control the body. The only thing you need is that you don't believe in the dualistic logic but in the monistic logic, into divine logic. Divine logic is never dualistic logic. It's always a one-valued logic. Divine logic and revelation coincide. They are both the same. If we believe otherwise, we may be sure that either our logic is at fault or that we have misinterpreted revelation. So here she shows that. And then she said, good never causes evil. There is no dualistic concept there. Nor creates aught that can cause evil. That's not logic. But human belief believes that. human belief, because it's dualistic, because it has all those material beliefs, that those erroneous postulates which we have taken in the main tone of spirit, it believes in the dualistic reality, in a dualistic reality where evil combines with good, where evil brings forth good, where good brings forth evil, where evil works together with good and good works together with evil. All that is not divine logic. And it does not coincide with revelation, which, because revelation says there is only one God and one universe. Then tone of life, that if that logic is not kept, that divine logic is not understood, that is then destructive. We have here in life the nature of the divine esse, divine being, does not contain anything evil or destructive. So the dualistic logic is destructive, the monistic logic is constructive. Good does not create a mind susceptible of causing evil. You see, that's the dualistic logic, that good can create evil through a receptive mind. For evil is the opposing error and not the truth of creation. Destructive electricity is not the offspring of infinite good. So we have to see that energy and material energy and electricity is not the true energy, the spiritual energy of which we are speaking. On the other side, whatever contradicts the real nature of the divine esse, esse means being, though human faith may clothe it with angelic vestments, is without foundation. We have to see that, you know, with that divine esse and electricity. Well, today we know that matter and energy is being synonymous, so to say. That matter can either show itself as matter or as energy. That's the great formula of Einstein, E=m². But energy cannot be seen. And so we must be aware that because energy is not seen, that is not spiritual. Just because it is not material seen, that it is not spiritual. So if today the trend of physics goes from physics to energy, which is not seen, that does not mean that it is spiritual because it's not material. It's just mental, and therefore Mrs. Eddy calls it the mortal mind, that energy is just mortal mind, and the concentration of mortal mind. So that doesn't really solve yet the question of matter for us. Only when we go further and see that also energy, which is intangible or not intangible to the physical senses, only then when one sees that energy is destroying itself, that then we approach more and more the metaphysical field and range. And then from the metaphysical, there is another step to the spiritual. Yes. Okay, that would be the main tone of soul.